All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's Art Chat with Michael Harding. My name is Sarah Alsfall, and I'm the webinar specialist here in the Fine Art Department at F&W. And I just want to thank everyone for joining us today. We will have some time to answer your questions. So if you have a question for Linda or Michael, please type that into the questions section of your GoToWebinar control panel, and I will relay those questions onto them on your behalf. So, all right. Welcome, Linda and Michael. You guys can go ahead and take it away.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I want to actually talk with Michael about his new colors that are out, and we're going to talk a little bit about canvas prepping and some other helpful, tips that he's going to pass along with us. Sarah, did you start the PowerPoint by chance?
I did, but I'm not sharing my screen, so here we go.
Oh, okay. that's better. The first photo that we have here, Michael, is you and I when we were filming Color Your World, and that was, gosh, a year ago, I think, around this time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were talking at that point about lapis and some of the other colors, but you have brand new colors that are out, so why don't you talk to us a little bit about what you released this year?
Okay, well, I mean, it's sort of the new colors. I don't know. Let me think. I've probably been introducing new colors now for probably a little over a year.
Mm-hmm.
For the past sort of 15 years, loads of artists have sort of been contacting me saying, hey, you're going to do this color, you're going to do that color. And I've just been so sort of busy that I haven't really had a chance to sort of consider adding new colors. And then I thought, you know, if I don't actually ever do this, somehow the years are going to click past. It's all going to be too late. So about 18 months ago, I decided to make a concerted attempt to introduce a number of new colors. And I'm slowly adding and bringing the range from 75 up to 100. And I think currently we're sitting at about 90, 89, 90.
Mm.
So, you know, for you guys out there who might have seen some of the new ones, I mean, colors like cobalt teal and Van Dyke brown and vine black, I introduced the range sort of last year, along with lead tin, yellow, lemon, and so on.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, there's a slow trickle of new ones as well, including a new warm white, which is getting a very, very good response. In fact, I must admit, I've started painting with it myself because I find it so sort of useful. And a warm light yellow as well, which is proving very popular. And for those of you out there who are sort of skeptical on the sort of performance of Alizarin Crimson, at last I've been able to introduce, if you like, what a lot of companies call their equivalent of Alizarin Crimson permanent Alizarin, which I thought was being a little bit unfair on Alizarin Crimson. So anyway, I've introduced my own, which I call Alizarin Claret, and that's based on a pigment red 177 for those of you out there who like those sort of number of references. That's from the International Color Index system, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a few other secret ones lined up, which I'm not going to divulge at this stage. So,
darn.
You know, just keep looking at the website from time to time. Oh, by the way, I'm very proud to say we've launched a lovely new website.
I was just going to ask you about that. Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of squidgy, nice images hopefully going to be on there. We're still adding bits to it as we go, but that's been a long time coming as well. It's the best part of 10 years. I can't believe it.
Oh,
I'm
wow.
Just alive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I, you know, it's one of those things. It's a bit like, I think of myself a bit like a chef in some ways, and so things have been emerging from the kitchen, you could say, and I've sort of been messing around with various combinations of colors as well as some single pigments. Some of you might be aware of things like amethyst, which I brought out last year as well,
mm-hmm.
Which are proving incredibly popular. And they, you know, they all have their own sort of idiosyncrasies and quirks. And the reason I added something like amethyst to the range, it's not made from stones, just in case anyone's wondering. It's a color which was just a rather beautiful violet. And the thinking behind it was that I had so many people who'd say to me, they'd be talking about cobalt violets, and they'd ask the question, well, look, cobalt violets, okay, they're nice, but are they really worth the sort of Series 6 price? And, you know, I have to be honest, yeah, if they work for you, who am I to say that it's not appropriate? I mean, if you're doing, say, a papal portrait, and you find it's the absolutely applicable violet to work with, then of course. On the other hand, people have said to me, you know, do I really have to pay a Series 6 price to sort of to get a Violet which can perform like that? And so often I've played around with Quinacridone Magenta and Ultramarine Blue and Pigment Violet 23, Darkazine, which just produces such a beautiful shade of violet. And so unashamedly, I just decided to mix these together for those of you who don't want to do the mixing yourself and just put it in a tube. So there you are. And it's proving incredibly popular. And I must admit, every time I look at it, I still have a bit of a wow moment for it because it's just, I don't know, it's just one of those things. When you combine certain colors, they just have a sort of frequency where they sort of resonate with one another. And I when I'm doing my mixing like this, I just try and get the best out of each.
Right. Well, let's step back a second because one of the colors that I discovered when we were down at Art of the Carolinas, in the Carolinas, whichever, however that is said, but was the cobalt teal, which I didn't realize that you had as part of your lineup, and I considered it one of your new colors because it was new to me. But
sure.
I kind of came, I mean, we've had conversations that I have asked you before about manganese blue, because when I mix the manganese blue with a nice yellow, I get this great marine green color that all of those hardworking boats up in the Bay of Fundy have on them and other bays like that. I'm sure you've seen them in Boston and along the coast. But that cobalt teal comes very close to that color that I was looking for. And I know that we've talked before that manganese is a very hard pigment to get your hands on. Is that still true?
Yeah, I mean, okay, there are one or two people out there who are experimenting with various ways of creating the pigment.
Right.
Just to fill you with sort of people who might not know, I'll give you the history of it. It's pigment blue 33 barium manganate, manganese, which is manganese blue. Mm-hmm. There was one manufacturer that I knew of, oh, this would be back in the 1980s, the big German industrial company BASF, and they stopped making it, as I say, back in the 80s, probably because it was only used by artist colors. And, you know, we are a small little corner of the pigment manufacturing industry our consumption for artist colors. And I know one or two companies were able to purchase sort of last makings and sort of stockpile it. Unfortunately, I wasn't. And, yeah, I get a number of people asking me for manganese blue, and it would be a color that, if it was made available, yes, I'd consider adding it back into the range.
Right.
I did actually make it for a while. This would be, as I say, in the 80s, and then when I stopped making paint commercially for a while, that's when it sort of ceased its production with BASF. I know what you're saying, Linda, because of the sort of combination of the yellow with that blue would give it that, you know, extraordinary turquoise quality, and I can see now why you're saying that cobalt teal comes a close mixer, as it were, for it. I must admit, when I look at cobalt teal, if you add a little bit of white to it, you know, sometimes you get those turquoise skies adjacent to sunsets. You can achieve it with that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's, for those that paint boats and marine scenes out there, please do check out that cobalt teal, because when I was down at Art of the Carolinas with Michael, visiting with Michael and Karen, I started playing with that color a little bit because Michael lets you play with the colors. Like, this is actually a picture that we're showing, Michael, are your tubes, and when you were here in Middletown, and you were letting artists play with the colors. That picture is actually showing right now, so that was a good one. But anyway, when I was playing with it, the range of color that you can get with that cobalt teal is amazing. So I fell in love with it. I bought a tube, I have to admit, and I'm getting ready to go actually play with that a little bit and do another marine scene. And like Michael said, you know, the perfect for the sky colors as well. So it's very warm color, very nice texture naturally. So very nice. So tell us about warm white. Where could we possibly use that in an application? Since you're painting now, you'll probably, you know, be able to tell us.
So okay, well, it's more a question where you can't use it. I mean, if you use white full stop, you'll find that it's got an addition of earth colors in it, which gives it sort of a golden, I suppose the best way to describe it is a very slight golden twinge underneath it. And it just gives it a sort of a slight creaminess. And you know, if you know, for everyone, it's very difficult, of course, when you try and talk on the radio and describe color. But if you saw a lineup of titanium white and zinc white and brass lead whites, and then you saw this warm white next to those, your immediate thing would be, oh, it's a white. It's not as if it's a sort of a really creamy by nature. It definitely is categorized in with the white and tonal value. It comes very closely to a Kremnitz white for its warmth, but of course there's, for those of you who do worry about toxicity, there's no lead whatsoever in it. It's purely combinations of titanium, zinc white, and one or two earth colors that I put in there just to give it that little bit of warmth. Very low oil content, so it's a nice, lean, heavy, dense pigment to be working with, paint to be working with. Yeah, I mean, quite honestly, everything from painting clouds to portraiture, as I say, when wouldn't it be of use? It's just such a nice, robust, mixable white. I mean, and it also is less harsh than a titanium. I think sometimes titaniums have this tendency to be very stark in a painting. Some of you might disagree with me on that, but I mean, that's just me speaking with my own artist hat on there for a moment. We all have our own friends, as it were, within a range of colours, and what works for someone might not necessarily work for someone else. Of course, it's a very subjective subject. Yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
And then
the
warm light yellow that you have, it's the difference between the warm white and the warm yellow, there's more yellow pigment in the warm yellow?
Exactly. What I've done is I've juggled around a handful of various earth colors, again, to produce a shade of it's an off-white, I suppose you could say. It's a sort of very light pale yellow, and it's an ideal color for sort of pastel shades where, for instance, you're mixing, say, Caucasian flesh tones. Again, a landscape painter, plein air painter, would find it very useful. It's just a very the tonal value of it is very high, of course. It's just another variation on a similar theme, if you like.
Right.
It's one of those things, of course, with the absence of the visuals on radio. It's a shame that I couldn't demo this before you put my fingers in it and hold it up to the camera, and that way you'd see it against my skin color, what we're actually talking about.
Right.
But no, that's it. I mean, it's I just wish everyone could try it.
Right. Well, I know that you're going to be traveling soon, but actually, we can talk towards the end where you're going to be at. So hopefully, some of the artists that are listening or will be listening to this will be able to, you know, stop in and see you and play with the paints again. So we'll talk about that. Where you're going to be traveling to a little bit later in the show. But the Van Dyke, is that what you said? The Van Dyke Brown is another one of the colors that you came up with?
That's right, yes. I mean, again, it's a shade of brown that will be familiar to very sort of traditional portrait painters. Visually, of course, in straight comparison, it just looks like a warm black with a sort of, as I'm looking at it here in front of me now, with a sort of a yellowish twinge to it.
Okay. Is it transparent?
Again, sort of, not really. No, and of course, any color, if you thin it down far enough, will have the appearance, you know, the appearance of a slight transparency. But it's quite a high covering color. Blacks are interesting. I mean, when I say black, of course, we're talking about a very deep brown, and this is, you know, the same conversation, of course, applies to the vine black here. They're colours which, in some ways, I mean, I personally can't paint with the black. I just find that it kills my paintings. I know it might sound a bit like an old-fashioned sort of art school professor there, but I find that whenever I add a black to my painting, it just ends up being a sort of a literal black hole, pulling all the light in and just kills my paintings. But then I know there's plenty of artists out there who just can't work without it. In fact, the last time I did a painting with black, I actually ruined it and had to scrape all the black back out. And I was doing a horse's portrait, and It makes it sound as if the horse was sitting for me, wasn't it? I can imagine this. And no, I was doing a portrait of a sort of a profile of a horse, and it had a dark background. Mm-hmm. And the particular day I was painting, it had quite a bad light in the studio I was working in. And I wasn't getting the tonal value I wanted, so of course I over-exaggerated and thought, you know what, I'm going to use a black today. And of course, on the day, it looked fine. The next day, I came to the studio, and there was a much better light that day, and I suddenly thought, oh my goodness, I've ruined it. It's just, you know, it's just a horrible, it just does not work. So I scraped it all back and ended up solving the problem just by a combination of ultramarine blue and burnt umber to give it that tonal value. And for me, blacks have to be, they have to be active. I can't just have a pure black. It just doesn't work for me. I know other right. people can make it work wonderfully, but not me, unfortunately.
Well, it's really interesting when you're talking about the Van Dyke brown, because when I use your black, I use it to make gray at some point, yep. but also to make landscape greens, and because yep. it provides a little bit different thing. So now I'm interested to figure out if I use your Van Dyke brown with yellow, what happens to, you know, do I get a different green color than I would if I would use blue or black with it? So I have to give that
one a try. Oh, most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in the same context of what you're talking about, I mean, another color which I've introduced recently is Italian green umber.
Mm.
Have you tried, did I show you that?
I remember hearing about it, and I think I looked over your shoulder when you were showing another artist, but tell us about
it. Yeah, that's also a must if we're talking in the same context when you're talking about taking umbers and adding yellows and yellows to black, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Italian green umber, I mean, it's a natural earth from, of course, Italy. It has, when you see it in mastone, again, it's almost, at first glance, it almost looks like a black again. When you make it transparent or make it very thin, it's unquestionably green, more of the sort of family of terra vert in a way.
Hmm.
In fact, alongside terra vert, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, I love the terra vert.
Thank you. Very low tint power, like terra vert. So, you know, it hasn't got that huge staining power that, for instance, a bethylacynine color would have. But, you know, we're talking about quite a soft, you know, in the same context as lapis. Lapis is a very has a very low tint power as well. And you get it on your fingers, and you can almost just rub your hands together, and it's gone. It's one of those.
Right.
Because, of course, if you did that with modern ultramarine blue or a bethylacynine, you'd just be in a terrible state. So, yeah, but again, this is a color which is absolutely beautiful. I have a mind, actually, sometime to do a portrait myself using it, and I'd like to put it into the shadows so uh-huh. that it would have the effect of... there was a trick that some portrait artists used in the old days where they'd put terra vert or a green umber under noses and under chins into the green shadows, and then you'd get the complementary thing going on. It would make the red cheeks, or rather make people with red cheeks, that the florid complexion, it just plays on the complementary much more and make right. And sort of is a way to make the colors more exciting, but still be within context.
Yeah, I always find it interesting when I'm teaching my students down at the Art Center, and, you know, they have this, they're naturally painting landscapes, and they have all this green on there, and I'm like, just put a little bit of red right in this, and they look at me like I'm crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's that pop that goes on when you do that compliment thing that actually we all love. So
yeah, and I must admit, sort of from a painting student point of view, and let's be honest, we're always all students throughout
yes.
our entire lives. Sometimes you have to take those brave moments and do something which might seem completely crazy, because that's sometimes where things come off,
right?
Succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Oil paint being quite versatile, and that you can, it's quite forgiving. So if an area is wrong, of course, it's up to you to remove it. Watercolors, of course, can be a little less forgiving. But for me, painting with oils has that advantage, because you can either just scrape it back. Another trick, of course, is just to get some cotton wool and very lightly just dab it over an area. I mean, if you've done a bit of a painting and you're blending in, again, for instance, I'm thinking sort of where you might be painting a flesh area of a face and it's become very precious and you've suddenly done something too bold, sometimes just rubbing very lightly with a piece of cotton wool can just lift a little bit of paint, just enough to
right.
you know, to take that statement back out. But we have to do these things, because that's the road to successful paintings. And I think that I always think of paintings that, you know, as artists, when we paint, we're actually entertainers to a great degree. Mm-hmm. And as you paint areas, in a sense, you have to have these little things going on, these little nuances of color, because that's what it's all about. And the audience who's going to be looking over your shoulder or viewing in the galleries in the years to come, or someone's home, it is about entertainment. And of course, their eyes going to dart around, not just from the point of view of design within the painting, but also the experience of color, if you like, is also going to be there. And we're entertainers, and that's all there is to it.
Right, right. And we certainly want to move the viewer's eye around the painting, and color is one way of doing that. So naturally, you have to have a strong composition always. But, you know, I like using little splashes of color here and there to help the eye move to one area or another. And I'm not alone in that. I mean, I'm not, you know, a number of artists do that. So.
Oh, yes. I mean, I always think of George Gallo when I think about doing those things, because George, he paints in a very sort of swashbuckling way. For those of you who don't know, you can certainly find his work very easily on the internet, George Gallo. And he just makes, he makes the impressionist look dull, in my mind. He just can, the way that he can throw color around and make it and make it succeed is just extraordinary.
Yes, yeah. I love his colors, and his colors are so vibrant, and of course became even more vibrant when he switched to your paints. And
That I like to think, yeah, certainly. I'm very proud to think of that George uses my paint now. Yes, that's true. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. So, I call it alizarin. You call it the claret. I can't pronounce it the way you do, Michael. It's just not in my
English. I know. You're probably thinking that everyone in England says it as alizarin crimson or alizarin. I change it. I just in my head for some reason. I've just got it stuck that way, so don't assume that all English people sound like me on that either. Sometimes I say alizarin, sometimes it's alizarin. I don't know. It's just maybe I'm verbally dyslexic or something. I just change all the time.
I have to say that the name of that, since I'm a wine drinker and I know you are as well, I mean, that just in my mind tells me what color I'm going to be looking at right away.
Yeah, don't tell everyone, Linda. They just think that I'm choosing colors for the world according to my drinking habits. I wouldn't want them to think that.
Well, they know already knew I drink wine, so it's not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whenever I look at red wine, I do find it inspiring, we could say. But who could not like the color of red wine? And of course, I've got rose madder as well, which is a relatively new color as well. Those colors are made from a number of sort of. For those of you who don't know, rose madder is made from a plant root, the Rubia tinctorium, and it's a plant that's quite common throughout Asia and the Mediterranean, and it occurs in many cultures as a dye, and our particular one comes from France, mm-hmm. and it comes from the plant root. The plant has to be 2 years old before the plant is mature enough to produce the quality of roots that are required. I'm actually even considering, I'd love to actually start making it myself, and I've actually started talking to the people in the UK who've got farms, and with a view to start planting the madder plant myself, which would be rather fun. And the trouble is, these things turn out to be very time consuming. That's the only drawback. Keeps me away from other stuff. Alizarin and crimson and rose madder are slightly fugitive in terms of if you put them alongside cadmiums and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I think they have such a sort of unique position in terms of their color beauty that they have to be there. If you don't like them, guys, you know, if you're of the school in the United States where you think the light fastness is just simply not good enough, another combination you can look at to get very close to sort of an alizarin crimson, if you take quinacridone red, the PR122 magenta, if you mix that with a little bit of either an umber or transparent red oxide, it just gives it that browning quality that will therefore, it just brings it very, very close to an alizarin crimson. Not exactly there, but very close. Does that make sense, Linda?
Yeah. What always I find impressive, Michael, is that you remember these numbers in your head. So it's just blows me away. But
I remember the ones I like. I mean, I must be honest. If someone started testing me on all the colors I make, I tend to find that I tend to dry up a bit where it comes to things like cobalt greens and cobalt turquoise. For some reason, I don't know, maybe their colors, no, don't get me wrong. It's not as if I dislike them as colors. It's just that they don't inspire me as an artist particularly.
Right.
Having said that, I've got a little bit of a story there on that. I was recently painting up in Vermont, and I was really struggling to get my greens right in this particular day. And there's one color I have to say which I don't like, and that's oxide of chromium, and I've always loathed it. Hmm. And this particular day, I kept on looking at the oxide of chromium, which I had in my box, and I was thinking, oh, go on then, give it a try. And you know what, it jolly well did it, and it really... It actually annoyed me because I've always enjoyed hating it, and now I've got to like it because it solved the problem that day. But I think probably all artists have got little experiences and stories like that. So yeah, oxide of chromium. Maybe there's a psychological reason why I've hated it for all these years. It's because that was the it's like an Achilles heel. That was the one that could solve the problem, as it were. But there we go.
Right.
We learn as we go.
Yes.
Sorry,
we
we're drifting off new colors a bit, aren't we?
A little. We talked a little bit about the emesis, and the only question I have there is the opacity of it. Is it more
very,
transparent?
It's very transparent.
Okay.
And so, I mean, if you were able to smudge a bit out on a piece of glass, like on a window, it would just look like stained glass. It's absolutely beautiful. A very, very clean, transparent combination of colors. Again, I wish we could show everyone that, because it's just such a beautiful... Mm-hmm. It does look like a jewel, I must say.
Oh, sounds nice.
Yeah, I mean, for me, of course, oil painting really is about the transparent colors, the things you can achieve with them.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm saying there's anything wrong with the opaque ones. It's just that they are, I just think, mind-blowing in terms of the visuals.
Yeah. Is it fair to say, Michael, that the colors that you were introducing over the past 18 months would make or help, however you want to say it, like the impressionist painters, the plein air painters more? Or is it just things that you always wanted to do and always and just decided to go ahead and do them? And it just happened to help the plein air painters?
Well, it's one of those things. Of course, I'm led by my artist users. I of course want to please them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've put a number of colors in the range, like our new French yellow ochre, our mm-hmm. Italian brown ochre, and of course the Italian green umber I've mentioned.
Right.
And in some ways, yes, of course you can look at those and think, well, yes, you've got the landscapes of California and Arizona there, and those sort of sandy brown colors and so on. But it always amazes me. We were over at the Plein Air Convention in Monterey earlier on this year, and I don't know if any of you know the Australian artist Leon Holmes. He was there, and he turned the cobalt teal into sort of, you know, there wasn't a part of his painting he wasn't using cobalt teal, and quite extraordinary. So I don't think there's no real rules as to what colours are applicable into what sort of palette and what sort of subject matter, really. It's, you know, there's no rule book.
Right.
It's for you guys to decide.
Right. And when I was thinking of the colors that you were that we've been talking about, there's always this beautiful range of grays, but they're not really grays. You know, there's this kind of green gray and all of this. And I was sitting there thinking about the colors that we've been talking about, and thinking how those colors could be incorporated into those areas in the plein air, you know, setting type of thing. So that's where I was going with that question. But like you said,
yeah,
there are no rules.
Oh, I know. And if CW Monday happens to be listening into this, he's going to be yelling out, "I told Michael so, I told Michael so," and he doesn't listen to me. CW's been on at me to make a range of special grades for I don't know how long, and I just never get around it. I did add one, what we call neutral grey, I suppose about 12 months ago as well. It has about the same value, I believe, as the Mountsall number 5, mm-hmm. for those of you who want to know. And really I introduced it to be just a completely neutral grey. But no, greys are very... very, very subjective again. I mean, talking to CW right. about it, I know it's some painters dwell in them and other painters don't.
Yes.
I mean, some of the decisions I make as a color maker are led either as by me as an artist or as a color maker. There's two ways I think of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always come out with logical answers, I suppose, is another thing of what I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a funny thing, making color. A lot of it's whim on the day. Some you know, forgive me that for that. I have bad mood color days as well, so sometimes I won't make a color if it doesn't appeal to me on the day. It's just it upsets my staff a bit, but I just if I don't like a color, I won't do it. If the skies are too gray, for instance, that's the sort of thing I'm talking about. It's all mm-hmm. it's all rather worrying.
Right.
But that's me as the chef again, if you like. If I'm not in the right mood, I can throw a bit of an artistic tantrum, I suppose.
But I don't think I've ever seen one of those, and I have a feeling I don't really want to either. So.
Oh no! It's not like that. It's just
no.
I just don't want to play, as it were. I'm just not right. in the right mood for it.
Right.
Whereas I always like making bright colors. Bright colors are fun.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, let me see what other colors we should be talking about here.
Okay.
We've done the neutral gray. I've talked about.
One thing.
Go on.
Unbleached titanium dioxide is another. I use that a lot, and I use it a lot to sometimes make grays. So, you know, that's one of the approaches that I use for it. And a lot of people can use that, you were saying, as prep to a canvas, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, just to some of you out there might not know the particular color we're talking about, some makers call it titanium buff.
Okay.
And it's a sort of an off-white, sort of biscuity beige color. Very useful in terms of its neutrality. It's a very mm-hmm. a very soft, very high covering power. It's also got a very low oil content. So if you're one of these people who's really concerned about the use of fat over lean, it's a color that you can rest assured will be very robust, and you can bury it accordingly. It's not going to move around much.
Right.
I know that probably sounds rather puzzling to everyone. It makes it sound like a wriggling color underneath. But no, in terms of it, when a color's got a low oil content, it doesn't expand and contract as much as a color which has got a high oil content.
Right.
But talking on microscopic scales, but of course this is the sort of thing that can undermine paint layers in future years.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of artists like it because it also resembles the color of linen.
Yes, it does.
If you're in the sort of the practice of stretching and sizing and priming your own linen, you'll know that, of course, when you first of all stretch linen, it has this marvelous sort of neutral tonal value to it. And then, of course, you either size it or prime it with maybe a lead primer or maybe an acrylic primer. And, of course, then you're back to white. And to paint on white, of course, is a bit of a struggle tonally, whereas, of course, the nice neutral color of the linen, and so that's why a lot of artists will use it as a ground. That's the unbleached titanium dioxide.
Right. So let's see, any other colors that we want to touch on that we haven't yet?
No, of course, stacked lead white is another rather, I'm trying to think how many years I've been doing. I've probably been doing stacked lead white now for about 2 years.
Right.
And that, of course, is the rather strange one with the that's the one we make by suspending lead over vinegar and burying under horse poop. It takes a few months to sort of come to sort of fruition, but
right.
it's for a while that was my favourite, and then I got rather tired of standing ankle deep in horse poop and pots and stuff like that. So I've gone off the boil with that, but I'll be making it again. We've got a stack at the moment bubbling away, and that'll be probably ready towards the end of January when I'm back in the UK again, and so. I'll be scraping off all the lead carbonate again then.
Yeah, we're showing right now, Michael, your new color chart, the one that you handed off, down at the Art of the Carolinas.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you want to talk about that sheet a little bit, maybe.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's primarily designed for the American artists, and that's why on that sheet there you'll see a number of our ambassadors and well-known users. of course, we've got a number of the new colors there at the time of it going to print. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that a lot of you artists are familiar with a number of the artists that use our paint, like Jeremy Lipking and David LaFell. I mean, the list is long, and I've already mentioned CW Monday and George, and then, of course, there's the very charismatic Alexis Steele. How could we forget him? And, of course, Dear Tony Pro. And I'm just looking over. I've got the leaflet in my hand as well. It also gives a guide to our various mediums. Oh, new mediums coming this next year, but I'm not going to divulge anything at this stage. But, a couple of good releases coming, and I'm very excited about that.
Okay.
We've got a nice impasto medium, which I know people will love. That's all I'm going to say about that one.
Okay.
We'll also be reprinting this sheet so that the new colors will be included on it. We've got some quite new, interesting things coming for the next year. I can't believe it. We're already nearly through 2015. I've only just got over the trauma of getting through 2014.
Yeah. Well, remember to send me if you can, or I'll send you an email, a new sheet, because I have this hanging down in the art center now, so they can see it all the time. But for a second, since I'm someone that doesn't use mediums, can you talk a little bit about your mediums and possibly how you use them or some of the other artists use them?
Yeah, I think that you touched on an interesting point there when you said you're an artist who doesn't use mediums. I tend to find that a lot of artists who use our paint simply don't find they need one.
That's exactly right.
There's no rule that says you have to be. I mean, sometimes when I'm doing talks and demonstrations, someone will put up their hand and just say, oh, so what medium should I use for this? And I then explain, you don't have to. Mm-hmm. I think some artists get so used to finding that when they squeeze paint out of various other makes and stuff that they can't quite achieve with the paint straight away what's in their mind's eye. And so they just get so used to also buying mediums to go with it. Of course you can. There's no rule that says you can't use a medium.
Right.
I always say to artists, if you can achieve what's in your mind's eye without a medium, then you don't need to add one. And that, of course, is the case with you, Linda. Clearly, if you can achieve with the paint what you want, then forget the mediums. You don't have to. Mediums can be problematic for some people because I think they sometimes expect too much of them. And I think they also think that maybe this is the missing ingredient to make up for the lacking of the skill. I don't want to be unkind about it. I think they think that if you can pick up a medium that, say, that Rembrandt painted with or Velázquez, that somehow it's going to turn them into a better painter. But that, of course, is not going to be the case. Most mediums are for certain purposes, either to ease the flow or to increase the gloss or increase the transparency or just to, you know, primarily to increase flow generally, or it could be a glaze medium. Mm-hmm. And I'll just very briefly explain what a glaze is. Suppose you've painted a portrait and you're very pleased with the result, and then upon reflection you decide that, for instance, the shadows aren't deep enough, and you think, well, I don't want to have to go and repaint all the shadows again. So what you do, you wait until those areas of shadow are absolutely dry, and then perhaps you'd put a bit of maybe burnt umber into one of the mediums to make it into a sort of, it would have the appearance of black coffee or black tea. And of course, once you paint it on, it very thinly, of course, it will then introduce a thin veil-like quality of color over an area, like the shadows, and therefore make them darker and deeper. So that's a very simple principle of what a medium is. Sorry, a glaze is.
Glaze, yeah.
And it's a sort of clever little trick, if you like. So, you know, a number of our mediums are designed for that. We do an impasto medium as well, based on wax. But I stress, unless you find that you can't achieve with the paint what's in your mind's eye, then you don't need one. But no, I'm really looking forward to the launch of something next year, which that's all I'm going to say, because I know it's just, I'm really pleased with what I've been developing, so I can't wait.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back on.
Watch the website for that. I beg your pardon?
We'll have to have you back on the show so that you can talk about the things that you don't want to talk about today. So.
That's right. That sounds fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
All very serious.
Yes. One question I have for you. Since I've been using your paints, Michael, I haven't actually varnished any of my finished paintings. I used to varnish them all the time when I was using dollar paint, if you will, because I found it gave them a little more vibrancy. But
yes.
can we talk about varnishing? Because that's always a question that some artists always ask me is, you know, should I varnish my painting and when should I varnish it and do I absolutely need to? Is it okay if it's not varnished? And, you know, so talk about some of the protectiveness that varnishes
sure.
will provide and why you should or shouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, really you should varnish a painting, but you shouldn't varnish it too early. Sometimes I'll get people who call me up and they say, oh, I've got a show that's starting in a week's time. The paintings are only just touched dry. Is it okay to varnish now? And I have to say no. Mm-hmm. The idea of leaving your painting 6 months at least to dry is because although a painting might be touch dry and therefore apparently dry, it's still not really dry. And the problem is if you put an oil-based varnish on the top, of course it can incorporate itself with the actual paint film. And therefore, in 100, 150 years' time or whatever it might be, when a restorer decides that he's going to restore your painting and remove the varnish, because of course a varnish you have to think of as a temporary coat, when they remove the varnish, taking the dirt with it, of course now it's slightly combined with the paint, and of course the paint is going to break away, which is the last thing you want. So that's why we generally suggest you wait at least 6 months. In fact, I'd prefer people to wait maybe a year. It's not going to do the painting any harm to be in an environment without, within reason, as long as it's not a sort of industrial setting or something, but in someone's home or a gallery setting, that would be fine for a year or two without varnish upon. But yeah, I always urge people to actually varnish. And as you say, of course, it will reunify the various paint surfaces that might be working there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll find that certain colors, like, say, umbers or lamp black, will tend to dry a little bit matte, dull looking. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the varnish will bring back that vibrancy. It'll give it that wet paint look again.
Right.
I tend to find that if you've got control of primers, then paint that the various layers of paint that you apply over a primer generally don't dry matte. A lot of people talk, of course, about oiling out or using a retouch varnish. I like to think that people don't need to use those with our paint. Having said that, of course, because of the nature of umbers, they being clays, they will just dry with a more matte looking surface.
Mm-hmm.
You can compensate for that for a degree when you paint by just, you know, dribbling maybe a couple of drips of a linseed stand oil into your paint medium, and if you're using a paint medium, or just touch your brush into linseed stand oil, and that will compensate for it quite a bit, because stand oil dries with quite a sort of, and I'm not talking about a huge amount, I'm talking about just a touch. It will just give it a deeper, more moist appearance, a more luscious looking value when it dries, and hopefully that alleviates it a bit. But no, coming back to varnishing, it is important. I often say to artists, actually, you know, for those who rather impatiently want their prints to be dry for their exhibitions, they then say, well, of course, what happens if I sell the painting? Do I then have to follow that painting halfway across the country if a collector's bought it and is now living, you know, hours away? And I say, well, yeah, you have to explain that to the new owner, that it is important to varnish the painting. In fact, I always urge artists to treat it as another sales opportunity, because if you think about it, if someone's been kind enough to buy a painting of yours anyway, and you can then show them how diligent you are about your materials by saying, you know, I have to visit your home in 6 months to a year's time to varnish the painting for you, to give it the right protection. It actually gives you another sales opportunity, I would say, because if someone's been kind enough to buy your painting, they're going to ask you when you visit their house, oh, have you been painting much recently, and, you know, how's it going, and they'll say something like, you know, we really enjoy looking at the painting, thanks so much for doing it. And you go, well, it just so happens I've got a couple more here in the car if you'd like to have a look. and it's my salesman hat coming on there. Of course, that gives you another opportunity to perhaps sell them a painting, because you've then got a one-to-one meeting when you've got the painting there, and who knows, and you're standing in their home. You might get lucky and end up leaving another one behind.
Right.
But no, that's the way I look at it. And I think that, of course, oil paint and varnishes, that it's an imperfect medium, but it's a wonderful medium to paint with. You can't make the oil paint and the varnishes do things that they don't like doing. And, you know, I must urge you not to try and varnish paintings too early. But there we have it.
Okay. Sarah has up a picture of mine of a painting that I did, and I just want to say the one that's showing right now for those of you that are listening to us, that was not done with Michael's paints. And the reason why I sent that to Sarah was because I wanted to show you the difference between painting with a particular paint that I am not going to name for this painting, and then Sarah, I don't know how long you've had this up, but can we like flip over to Michael's paints, the one with Michael's paint? And this is the one with Michael's paint. And I don't think I have to go back and forth. I think you can see the difference in the vibrancy of the colors and the. But she is flipping back and forth. She's very good. Thanks, Sarah.
So, I couldn't resist.
So you can see the difference in the vibrancy. And Michael, I don't think you remember the painting, but it's the one that I call The Road in the Shire. It's a path, and it has mountains in the back, and it's a dappled effect on a path. And that was the this particular painting was the first painting that I used Michael's paints on. I started out with another manufacturer, and then I did this one, painted over that with Michael's paints. So you're not really actually getting, you're seeing the difference, and it is, that's what woke me up to the fact that I needed to be painting with Michael's paints, or better brands of paints, if you will, than what I had been using. I had been using a student grade paint before, from a different manufacturer, and that's when I made the change to Michael's paints, and because I could see it just standing there looking at it, just like you saw with the flip back and forth, there is a vast difference, and that comes down to the amount of one thing, I think, and this is a question to you, Michael, that comes down to the amount of pigment that is in your paints versus others?
There's two ways of looking at it. One is, of course, because it's got such a high pigment load, and in simple terms, think of it, therefore, as a concentrate. And the other thing is, therefore, it's an absence of other stuff. And the other stuff being, of course, fillers and extenders. We don't use fillers and extenders at all. And the thing about fillers and extenders, although they're sort of invisible, you can sneak them into the paint, and therefore a paint maker wouldn't have to use so much pigment. It's also actually interfering with the light waves. So you just get less bang for your bucks, if you like, in terms of the vibrancy of the color as it comes to your eye.
Mm-hmm.
It's without diagrams and stuff, it's very difficult to explain what goes on.
Right.
But, you know, if supposing I've made an ultramarine blue, which is essentially 50-50 ultramarine blue pigment with 50% linseed oil, and then I decided to make perhaps a student quality paint or a lesser paint, I might put in something like calcium carbonate. If you start putting in sort of 10 or 20% calcium carbonate, because it's a dry material, of course, it makes the paint thicker and therefore take up more oil, and therefore you've displaced the true pigment, the ultramarine blue. Although if you put calcium carbonate into linseed oil, it appears to be transparent. It actually looks like Vaseline. It has no real, although when I say calcium carbonate, which of course is chalk, if you ground it up into a powder, it looks white. But mm-hmm. once you put it into linseed oil, of course, it becomes transparent, like a sort of, it has the appearance of Vaseline, say, it's slightly opaque.
Mm-hmm.
It's still going to be interfering with the light waves, and of course, because you've now got less ultramarine blue pigment there's less particles that's going to be reflecting light back up to your eye, and sending that very important message to the brain of the maximum amount of color it's seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost... It's one of those things that can't be explained, but then when you see it, if for instance we were able to put up a panel of two blues, I know you flash back and forth with your two paintings,
mm-hmm.
and that's when it becomes apparent. There's a sort of luminosity in the color as well, which is apparent when you're painting with a concentrate.
Right. You know, it was interesting because I was, you know, at the time that I had been doing the painting, the one that I was doing with the other brand of paint, you know, I was really, really struggling, and I, you know, kept thinking, oh, I'm never going to get this. It's me, it's me, it's me. And then all of a sudden, I find your paints, and I'm like, wow, you know, maybe it wasn't me. Maybe it was my materials.
You, sorry to interrupt. You just touched upon such an interesting thing there when you said you were struggling.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I would say to artists, painting's difficult enough as it is. Don't make it any harder. And if you're struggling to make the paint do something that it doesn't want to do, it's just adding to the distractions that your mind's having. I mean, when you're painting, you almost want to be on autopilot so that you're not having to actually think so much about the paint. You're just finding that your mind is taking over almost from the subconscious, and you, as if you're on autopilot, and it's the autopilot that's doing the painting, and you're just there almost watching. It's a bizarre feeling when it happens. But when you start getting situations where you're struggling with the material to make it do something, that's just distracting, and you're never going to have the fluency you really need as an artist.
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, it was such an aha to see the difference between the two colors, the vibrancy and the handling of the paints and things like that. And then, you know, to actually start painting again, that realization that it was the material that I was using and not so much me. It was so freeing. And so, you know, that's one reason why I will always be using your paints.
Thank you. Thank you so much. No, I often say to artists that they say, oh, but your paints are more expensive. And we're often not if you actually really study the prices. But the thing about ours is that it goes like three times as far. And it's certainly not three times the price. Mm-hmm. And it just means that the immediacy of the artistic statement is that much more concise and cleaner and vibrant, and you're just going to hit the target earlier, as it were, if you're mixing color. And as I said, of course, a painting has to be entertainment, and if you can make the paint surface entertaining in terms of all the visual things that are going on within it, the viewer will be entertained.
Right.
It all matters.
Okay, well, we have a couple minutes. I want to encourage our listeners to type in their questions if they haven't already so that Sarah will have some to ask of Michael. We got about 3 minutes left before we actually go to the questions, Michael, so I wanted to see if there was anything else that you wanted to pass on to our listeners.
I intend to be making a little film with a good friend of mine soon, a guy called Leo Mancini-Hereshko. He's a Boston-based artist, and Leo spent a number of years at the Florence Academy, both as a student and also as a professor there. And I must admit, he showed me a technique recently that he uses for using rabbit skin glue to stretch over panel. Linen over panel, and I found it very, very inspiring. And the way he uses it was completely unlike any way that I'd ever used rabbit skin glue before. So it's something I'm quite excited about. So hopefully Leo and I will be getting together soon and doing a little demo. We'll try and turn it into a YouTube film. That's the idea. And we'll have it on our website and put it on YouTube and all the rest of it. So I'm looking forward to doing that.
Okay. And the episode that you and I filmed is available in its entirety out on my website. LindaFissler.com is my website. Michael, tell them your website.
www.michaelharding.co.uk. That's .co.uk. It's not a .com because that's how we do things in England.
Right. So, and I think, Sarah, if you want to unmute, I believe we're probably ready for questions from our audience.
Okay, let's see. We only have one question so far, so everyone please type your questions in. This first question is from Salvador, and he asks, hi, when will you be reintroducing Kremnitz White and Foundation White?
We have those both available. Foundation White came back in a couple of months ago, and
great.
Kremnitz as well also. So, yeah, of course... Sorry, was it Salvador, the artist? Did you say the name?
Yes.
Yeah, Salvador obviously had a difficulty getting our lead whites for a while. They're available everywhere, frankly. And unless, of course, Salvador happens to be in the UK or Europe, unfortunately the EC, the European Economic Community, has decided in their wisdom that artists aren't responsible enough to be painting with lead whites, despite the fact they've been painting with them for thousands of years. And so the only way that an artist in the UK can generally paint is if they're a restorer. I know there's a few people who are selling lead white paints privately, but generally now, if an artist goes into a store in the UK, they have to produce a certificate which shows that they're a bona fide restorer. It's all rather silly. But in the United States, they're freely available, and our lead whites are available alongside all our other colors at the moment.
Okay. You can always email me. Sorry,
say it again.
We have another question, but what were you going to say?
That's it in a nutshell. You can always email me, and I can always point you in the right direction if someone's desperate to find something. We have a pretty good idea of who's got what and where in the United States. And we're currently in something like 60 or 70 stores, and of course a number of those companies do online sales. So if you visit our website and you just go to the where to buy column and click on your region or put an address or a part of the United States that you're in and into the search bar, and it will come up with a store hopefully near you.
Okay, he says fantastic. Thank you very much.
Great.
This next question is from Irlinda, I believe is how you say it. I've always painted in watercolors and want to start painting in oils. Living on a disability pension and my funds are limited, so what paints would you recommend to start with?
Well, okay, if someone's clearly on a very limited budget, you can within our range, within series 1 and 2, find very easily a complete palette. If the person is a watercolor artist, then undoubtedly the way they want to play around will be with the transparent colors.
Right.
Undoubtedly, ultramarine blue has to be in the palette. It's a series 1, so it's very affordable. It's probably the most universally used blue. Of course, it's the synthetic version of the genuine lapis, rather more expensive and exotic original blue. But no, an ultramarine blue is an absolute certainty to be in there. If the artist is maybe a landscape painter, then of course you just find colours which are sympathetic towards the landscape. But again, as I was saying, you everything from burnt umbers to ultramarine blues to they're all available in series 1s and 2s. It's a very subjective thing when people actually ask me what colours they should be painting with, because only really you guys can decide that. And I mean, if you're a watercolor artist, and I would just simply say, use colors you're familiar with, but just use the oil equivalents.
Right.
That's, of course, there's the odd occasion where a color, a watercolor pigment might not be available as an oil and vice versa. But generally they are. But to start simply, usually start with 5 or 6 colors and just find just feel your way. Now, the beauty about about oil paint, of course, is that in many ways, you can make it behave like a watercolor by thinning it right down. And, of course, there are a number of specially treated papers out there on the market now. I'm thinking of the Arches oil color paper, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you're a watercolorist and thinking, hey, you know what, I'd love to try oils, you can almost just flip over without really noticing a difference, in all honesty. You can actually make an oil paint behave in a very similar way to a watercolor once you've thinned it right down.
Yep.
I mean, I often paint like that myself. I build the very, you know, when I start a canvas, I draw in areas like that, and almost as if it's a wash-like quality to it, right. So I can get my tonal values and slowly start introducing color.
Yep. And Sarah,
great question.
Go ahead, Michael.
That's a great question, though.
Yeah. Sarah, I just want to offer here as well is I'm going to be offering some online courses off of my website, and one of them happens to be getting started with oil colors or oil painting. So keep an eye out for that. Just wanted to do that little plug. Sorry for the shameless plug there. But any more questions out there?
That's okay. Go on.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say we do have one more question, or rather, maybe it's a suggestion from Garth. But Garth is wondering if you can put a color chart with the pigment names and numbers up on your website.
Yeah, we'll be doing that. And at the moment, we've just launched our new website, and there's on the color section, we've got to do some work there, so apologies for that. That's still under construction. The previous website had all that, and of course, it's just one of those things that we haven't quite put into place. If there's anything specifically Garth would like to know, then of course, you can email me the question, and I can do it. I can also, I don't know if any of you know about the Wayback Machine. You can, if you put into Google Wayback Machine, you go to a website and then simply put in the website address, and it gives you a historic snapshot of various websites. So that's another way you can look at our old website, for instance, and that will give you the color index numbers of just about every color, depending upon when the last update was done. But to Garth's question, yes, it will be coming. Apologies, it's not already there.
Okay, thank you. And then Judy just wrote in, could you tell us about your burnt sienna?
Yeah, my burnt sienna is a natural earth, of course, Italian. It's got quite a large pigment particle. When I say large pigment particle, probably about 10 microns. So if you rub it between your fingers, you can slightly discern, I won't call it a grittiness, but you can feel, I don't even want to use the word coarse, but you can feel that there's a body there to it, almost like a grinding sort of powder to it. It is very delicate. It's a color which can be used, you know, in every aspect of painting, from portraiture to landscapes. It's, you know, really for the artist to decide the context of whether it's sort of relevant for you or not, but very popular. Series one, so it's very affordable. Yeah, what more can I say? Please try it.
Okay, I think that's all the questions we have for now, so we'll see if we get some more in here in the next few minutes. Type your questions in, everyone.
Yeah, and in the meantime, Michael, I wanted to ask about, we had a picture of your cobalt blue up. Is that a new color?
Yeah, cobalt blue's been in the range since the very early days of me making.
That's what paint. I thought. That's what I thought. But tell them about the cobalt blue, since I asked.
Oh well, it's just a beautiful color. What can I say about it? It's the sort of the cobalt's very interesting because it can survive very high heats.
Uh-huh.
I was told many years ago that a lot of meteorites that enter the Earth's atmosphere have a lot of cobalt, and actually the only reason they make it is because it. I mean, make it through to the Earth's surface because it's got cobalt in it. No, it just makes a beautiful blue. Of course, its predecessor was smalt. Yeah, it doesn't have the same tin power, say, as ultramarine blue. It's a color which I occasionally use if I'm doing a blue sky. I'll mix it with ultramarine blue. It's a slightly more red shade than our ultramarine. Yeah, it's just lovely. I mean, why did you think somehow it was a new color?
Just because it made it into the pictures, to be honest. I thought I remembered it being there. So
I can't see your pictures, so I'm...
Yeah, right. It's just a picture of all the tubes like stacked up, and it's all cobalt sitting there. So.
Oh, okay. That, I don't know. I'm not, is this on my website somewhere?
It might be. I haven't looked at your new website. I need to go out and look.
Oh, but, okay. I just can't think which picture this could be, but never mind.
Yeah, it's just probably a stock photo that you guys took, probably for the new website. So, yeah, it probably is out there. So, do you offer a cerulean?
Or yes, we do indeed.
Okay.
And I mean, I'm even considering adding another shade of it, actually. There's two shades which are commercially sort of available, and I'm considering adding another one, which mm-hmm. is slightly sort of, from sort of an artist's point of view, maybe slightly more opaque in appearance. And they have the color index numbers. Of course, it's pigment blue 3.5 and 3.6,
okay.
Which slightly make the chemistry slightly different there, and that's why the colors are slightly different. But I tend to find that often artists will send me an email saying, literally, are you considering adding this color? And that's, I suck it into my brain and decide whether or not it's, one, of course, it's got to be available, and secondly, it's got to actually work. Sometimes one artist will ask something, and they'll be the only artist who's asked for something in 10 years. Of course, that won't particularly be inspiring to everyone. Go on.
I was just going to say the Chinese vermilion, were there supply issues for the pigment, and is it that back out now?
Yeah, absolutely. Quite a story there. For those of you who don't know, I got very frustrated because my supplier decided he'd keep on edging the price up to me. And so I started trying to make, I succeeded in making the pigment myself by combining mercury with sulfur in what's known as the wet method. Produced the most beautiful red shade, I must say, and I made about 10 kilos of the pigment. And then I decided, because if the people who were supplying me the pigment could sell it to me at such an extortionate price, I'd sell them mine. And when they realized that I was actually making it, they decided they'd drop the price back down. So that's why we have the million back. But for any of you out there who want to ever experiment with making vermilion, I would err on the side of caution. Of course, anything involving mercury is rather questionable anyway. Mm-hmm. But the thing about mercury is that when you stir it, it builds up heat very quickly. Being such a dense material, it can suddenly raise... I was using a little stirring machine, like a rather similar to a kitchen blender, moving very, very slowly. And if that stirs a couple of kilos of mercury, don't believe it or not, it can suddenly shoot up to about 200 degrees, 300 degrees centigrade. And as it stirs in the sulfur, what happens then? It ignites the sulfur. So I had a little fire. So I'd urge people to be careful on that one if they want to experiment with that.
I think I'll let that up to you.
yeah. And the thing you have to be careful with mercury anyway is mercury produces poisonous vapors. So although I was doing it in a very controlled environment, it's not something you should try at home, folks. I'm rather glad, actually, that I am now back to my old Chinese supplier, and so we've got it available again. And, of course, it's as beautiful as ever. There we have it. That's one of my little adventures of last year. I had a little fire, you could say.
I just get this picture of you being a mad scientist. You know,
yeah, everyone says that now. I think I'm slowly going grey. It's all going to happen, isn't it? But give me another 10 or 20 years, and I'll probably be looking like Albert Einstein, and there'll be explosions everywhere. Yeah, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. Okay, but Sarah, any more questions coming in?
Yeah, we got a few more. Judy wants to know if you can talk about your cadmium colors.
Yeah, okay, cadmiums. Again, that's one that the Europeans, but the EC was trying to ban recently, but we managed to fight it and get the Swedes apparently found a river with a lot of more cadmium than they were expecting, so they decided to blame artists and the manufacturers of batteries, not that we throw paint into rivers in Sweden. Of course, cadmium is a naturally occurring mineral, I understand, so I don't know if it comes from Sweden, but you have to consider often these things are completely natural minerals. Yeah, cadmium is absolutely essential for an artist. Things like, you know, for a portrait painter, cadmium yellow or cadmium red, they're very robust, very, very light fast, very low oil absorbing, so again they're a very lean, heavy colour in your hand, just indispensable in terms of intermixing. Not great performers, particularly a cadmium red, and I'm generalising here, I'm talking about not just Michael Harding paints, but any manufacturer of cadmium colours. You tend to find that when you combine a cadmium red, say, with a titanium white, it's not going to give you the best pink, as it were. It tends to have a sort of a graying, bluing effect upon the two. Mm-hmm. So it's not the greatest way to cadmium reds and oranges in their own right can do some very remarkable, strong mixes, but they're not friends of titaniums. But then again, that's just my opinion. Another artist might say, I just love the way you get these muted, slightly grey down reds, it's for you guys to decide if it works for you or not.
Okay.
Toxicity. Yeah. Technically, of course, cadmium is poisonous to the human body, but when pigment manufacturers make it with sulfur and selenium, a cadmium yellow is cadmium sulfide. They then add more selenium, so it's cadmium sulfide selenium, and that then produces the oranges, and the more selenium there is in there, the redder it gets, of course. Mm-hmm. Now, as I said, cadmium on its own is poisonous as a heavy metal, but when it's combined with sulfur in the form of what chemists call a compound, some of you might remember that from school chemistry days, fortunately, it makes a compound which is virtually impossible for the human body in any form of chemistry, I'm thinking about stomach acids, to separate out the cadmium, say, from the sulfur. So from our point of view, from a toxicological point of view, they really aren't poisonous. However, of course, toxicologists make us put certain warnings on the side of the tubes, and so all our tubes carry that warning. Smokers are particularly at risk with cadmium colours, because should they get cadmium paints on their fingers and then on the side of the cigarette, and then, of course, they burn and inhale the smoke from it, and they are then, of course, mainlining, if you like, cadmium paint straight down into their lungs, which is not a good idea. I always try and encourage artists to keep food and anything that involves putting paint near your face, you know, even coffee cups. And we've all done that thing where you put your brush into your coffee cup in your studio and give it a good twirl around, then take a swig of the coffee 5 minutes later and spit it out because you detect the taste of paint and you realize what you've done. I think everyone's done that. But no, I don't personally consider cadmium colors toxic, but always read the label and always carry out what the instructions say. I hope is that enough on cadmiums, or shall I talk more about it? I think they're great colors, and they are certainly, if we didn't have them, it would make a serious hole in our arsenal, if you like, of color.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think that's probably good. We had another question come in from Gail about the warm white. She says, I don't see the warm white listed for sale on either Blick or Jerry's. Do you know if it'll be coming soon?
It will be coming soon. It probably is on a boat crossing the Atlantic at the moment.
Oh, good. There we go.
I made it about 2 months ago. We watched it for about a month just to make sure that it, the oil, too much oil didn't come to the surface of it when we sit it around in huge tubs. And we tube filled it about 3 weeks ago, so it probably is on a boat about now, coming to the United States. Yeah, you will find it, and I'm pleased to say it's a series one. So and I'm sitting actually looking out of a window at the moment in Massachusetts, looking at a blue sky, and I'm looking at white clouds. And there is the warm white. So there we have it. I like a landscape that paints itself.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I'm looking at gray clouds, and I'm in Ohio, so.
Okay, well, you're only down the road, but that's funny, isn't it? You know, we've got blue skies.
Yeah, we were clear this morning, so I think these clouds are probably on their way to you, too, considering the way El Nino is working.
Yeah, but we're looking forward to more rain later, I'm sure. I just spent an hour or two before coming on the road trying to break up a beaver dam, which is in our backyard at the moment. And I managed to slip in. So 15 minutes before coming on this show, I was up to my chest in water waiting. And it was a very awakening experience, I might say. So I had to jump in the shower and then come on the radio. So here we are.
Okay.
But anyway, do we have any more questions?
We don't. I think that was all of... Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Oh. Let me see. Gail says, any chance of, alizarin or... I don't know how to pronounce this.
The alizarin crimson?
Orange.
Oh, the orange. Quinacridine.
Yes, quinacridine orange coming
through. Still doesn't say it right, but Michael will say it.
I haven't got... good news for her at the moment, but I will have a look at it, put it that way, and if enough people ask me for it, then it would be considered. I'm still making up my mind about the last 10 colors I'm going to add to the range, One we're almost certainly going to be adding is green gold, yellow 129. So it's a bizarre looking colour, I must say, but it has that. It's really quite wacky. It's a, for those of you who don't know, it's a sort of it's a transparent green, and it's got this sort of yellow mossy appearance to it in the mast tone. But when you stroke it out so it's transparent, it is just absolutely beautiful. When you put a bit of magenta or something with it, and so you get this sort of complementary thing going on with it, it just does some bizarre things. I don't completely understand what I'm seeing sometimes, but yeah, I know people have other makers of oil paints have green gold, so that one's coming. Yeah, I'm not sure when. It should hopefully be next year.
Cool. And then Cheryl wants to know, who are your American distributors?
My actual distributor is a company called Armadillo, who are based in New Jersey, and they basically import and distribute artist materials. And then, of course, we have about 60 or 70 stores in North America, everyone from Blick to Jerry's to the Italian Art Store. And again, you can find all those stores listed on our website.
Okay. Salvador wants to know, does the MH Naples Yellow contain lead?
We make three Naples Yellows. Two of them do, yes. The ones which we call genuine Naples Yellow, light and dark, they are made with lead antimoniate, and their color index number is pigment yellow, PY41. We also make a synthetic version of Naples Yellow, which is pigment brown 24, which is made from antimony and chromium. I'm just trying to remember the particular chemistry of that one, which a lot of makers have in their range, and that's pigment brown 24. So it's a synthetic version of Naples Yellow. We also call it Naples Yellow. But the genuine Naples Yellow light is a very strong lemony shade. It's almost like a cadmium yellow light or lemon. And then the deeper shade is, let me just have a look at my color chart so I can sort of do a bit more of a, the genuine Naples Yellow dark would be broadly described as being a bit more like an ochre. But they're quite vivid, and for a portrait artist or a landscape painter, they're very valuable. They're just great mixers. I know that Jeremy Lipkin likes the Naples Yellow light.
Okay. And then Judy wants to know if there are any good in-depth books about color, the differences in color, their composition, etc., that you would recommend.
Well, I think Linda Fissler's book would be certainly worth a look at. So. And I'm sure she'll be happy to jump in and say whether she covers those subjects or not. Coming back to books on colour, I always like to get artists to read the Ralph Mayer book, The Artist's Handbook of Methods and Techniques. It should be in every artist's studio. You don't have to read the whole thing. It's a bit of a scary, thick book. It's about 3 inches thick, but there's about 100 pages, particularly relevant there to oil painters. And Ralph Mayer deals with all other aspects of colour. I'm trying to think of others out there. We have a section on colour theory on our website. So that's another one you could consider looking at. Let me think about it. Get her to email me, and perhaps I can think of I've got a book list that several other people have asked me sort of recently, and off the top of my head I can't remember the names, but there are out there, and even if you do a Google search on an Amazon or something like that, it'll probably come up with one or two books that've got colour theory. There's some quite fun books on history of pigments as well, which might be worth a look at.
Yeah. In a how to paint from brush to palette knife book that Michael said, that is my book that's out there. I do have a few things in there about color relationships and how I use his unbleached titanium dioxide is in there, and there is naturally some references to why I use Michael's Michael's paints. So that is all in the book. Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, I've just been thinking, actually, when I talk to artists, sometimes artists like to have all this sort of information. Mm-hmm. Other artists, they just get on and look at things and it doesn't trouble them. I was talking to my friend Leo Mancini Horeshko about this the other day, and he said, you know what, Michael, I don't do any of this knots or scale stuff or anything like that. I just mm-hmm. look and I see. And so there's two philosophies, if you like. Some people like to get the nitty gritty and understand, you know, the warmth and the colds and the and so on and gray values, and other people just get on and paint.
Right.
I must be honest, I'm more of the school of just getting on and painting, but for those of you who want to analyze it, yeah, I can understand it.
Right. And naturally Great and Parrish does a lot with that the Munsell color guide. Or whatever it's called. I'm one of the ones that get on and paint with it. Yeah, the Munsell scale. Thank you. Actually, you might want to check his website because I think he has something out there about it. So Great and Parrish, when I ran into him, I actually was going to have him on the show to talk about that. So that's a great reminder.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure he could shed more light on it than I can as a paint maker or as an artist. As I say, I think you either dwell in that area or you don't. And I must be honest, I tend not to. I just get on and paint and try and understand what I'm seeing and step back and I understand complementaries. Of course, that's essential, and you can use those. It's a very subjective matter.
Yes, it is. So, totally agree. Anything else, Sarah? We're coming down to the close of the show.
Gail says, one last request. What about a nice ropey white? What do you recommend?
Oh,
well, my ropiest white, of course, is my stack lead white.
Yes.
it just has marvelous, what can I say? I mean, when we talk about ropey, it's generally thixotropic. In other words, you stir it and it becomes more mobile. And there's a quality that exists in stack lead white, but when it first squeezes out of the tube, it's like dense, like cold butter. Mm-hmm. But once you start to manipulate it with a brush or palette knife, it starts to then become stringy, ropey, and it'll start following the brush around, and it starts to have slight flow like syrup. Mm-hmm. And then it re-solidifies after a couple of hours, and of course that's the sort of the white that the old masters would have been working with.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love it. So it's one of the ones I use.
Good, good, good. Well, I can't believe where the time's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, so we got a couple minutes here. Sarah's going to talk real quickly, though, Michael, in the next couple months. I know you're going back over to England to work in the factory and create some new stuff. But are there going to be any places that folks can stop by and play with your paints?
Oh, heavens, let me think. I think we're doing All Paints of America down in Texas, but I'm not particularly sure of the dates and the times and stuff like that. Oh, heavens, I should have actually prepared this. But you know what we should do? We'll make announcements on our website from time to time when there are these things. I mean, I like doing store demos. I just returned from, I came back from the UK on this last Saturday, and I did about five up and down the country in the UK there. Mm-hmm. So my mind's gone a bit blank as to where I'm meant to be next.
Yeah, and feel free to text me anytime that you're going to be somewhere, and I'll be happy to put it out on my social media so that folks can stop by and see you too. So,
thank you, and we should do the same. Thank you very much. Yeah, but people can always email me and ask me particular questions and stuff like that. And we'll try and post stuff on Facebook or something like that.
Right. Okay. So Sarah, thanks everyone for joining us. And Sarah, why don't you go ahead and.
Oh, yeah, I just want to remind everyone that we have the special coupon code for our Art Chat listeners. It's ArtChat10, and you can use that at northlightshop.com to save 10% off your entire order. So if you're going to do some last-minute Christmas shopping or want to pick up a few things for yourself, be sure to take advantage of that coupon code. And visit artistnetworkuniversity.com to find online art courses. Linda teaches over there from time to time, so keep an eye out for courses from her. And, that's about it. Anything else from your end, Linda?
Well, I was just going to say, not to confuse everyone, if you go out and look for how to paint from brush to palette knife, It will not be in the Northlight shop. Sorry about that. It's actually out on Amazon. So, sorry. Just didn't want to cause any more confusion than we need.
Oh yeah, we don't have that, but you can. But it's just our special offer. But yeah, pick up Linda's book on Amazon for sure.
Yeah, and then Michael, just wanted to say thank you for joining us and taking time to talk with us. I found it very interesting. I hope our listeners will as well. So.
Well, thank you very much. It's always fun to talk, and thanks for the opportunity. And please, anyone out there, if there's anything I said that seems a bit strange or vague, please email me, and I'll try and explain or elaborate more. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, everybody have a happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, all of those good things, and Ramadan, I guess, is in there as well. So happy holidays to everybody. Have a good one. Be safe, and we'll see you in the new year. We'll probably, I'm working with Jennifer McChristian, hopefully that we will be able to talk with Jennifer when she gets back in January. So happy holidays, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.